Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm your host, John DeLynn. And I'll have to admit, it's been a while since I've done one of these interviews. For those of you who are Facebook friends with me, you'll know that the past few months I have been immersed in two main things. One is applying for internship, which is the final stage in getting your PhD as a psychologist. And I'm happy to report that I just matched and I'll be attending the Utah State University Counseling and Psychological Services, counseling USU students starting in August, from August to July 2014 to 2015. And I'm super excited to be able to stay home and not have to leave Cache Valley for now, and to be able to continue trying to help the types of people I, you know, went to get my PhD for. So that's super good news, but I apologize to my listeners for how long I've been away. In addition, I also defended my dissertation, and that's a huge step. It was successfully defended. All three of the papers for my dissertation are either published or soon to be published. I should say accepted for publication and will soon be published. And I'm just thrilled. So I've got time to do interviews again. And so I want to thank all of you for your patience in waiting me out, and I hope that I'm a lot more productive in the future. So with that, I want to welcome my guest to Mormon Stories. His name is Matthew Garrett. Hi, Matthew.
Hello.
Matthew, I'll do a little introduction real quick. Today's topic is on what I'll call the LDS Indian Placement Program. So basically, we're gonna get into depth on it. Some of you may know a little bit about it, but basically, early in the let's just say in the somewhere in the 1900s, we'll explore it. The church decided that they wanted to help, as I understand it, the Lamanites blossom like a rose, and so they and Matthew, you can correct me later, but they went to reservations and found children who were willing and able to relocate, and they had kind of a foster care program where the children were relocated into sort of, I'll just say, Caucasian or white LDS family homes and raised in those homes with the idea of helping them flourish. And we'll talk a lot more about it, but I'll introduce Matthew. That's just kind of the teaser. I should say it was a very controversial program, and we'll talk about that too. But Matthew is currently an associate professor of history at Bakersfield College in California. He teaches California Native American Indian history courses along with United States history. He got his bachelor's in history from BYU. He got his master's in history from University of Nebraska, and his doctorate in history as well, American history at Arizona State University. His field of interest is Native American history, so this is his area of expertise, and his dissertation was specifically on the Indian Placement Program. So this is certainly, if not one of the guys or gals on this topic, maybe the guy on the Indian Placement Program. Just as a side note, he lists that he is a devoted husband and a father of three adorable little girls. And for those who care, he mentioned that he is currently an active Mormon. So, Matthew Garrett, welcome to Mormon Stories.
Thanks. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to get to talk with you.
And, oh, my pleasure as well. And I should note, you reached out to me years ago. Is that right?
Yeah, probably 10 years ago I somehow got in touch with you. I don't remember the details of how, but I was studying some of the different topics of Mormon history and ran into some of the work you were doing somehow. I don't remember the details though.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you did, and I'm sorry that it took us this long to actually record the interview. I also should probably thank Paula Goodfellow for helping make this happen. But just so glad to have you on, Matthew.
Thanks.
All right. Well, so if you were, I kind of did a hacked up job of describing the Indian Placement Program. If you had to give it sort of a paragraph's worth of an explanation or description for our listening audience, how would you describe what it was?
The placement program was an institution, a program operated by the church, intended to help, as you said, redeem and help blossom as the rose the Native Americans that Mormons had anticipated would eventually be redeemed. You can see earlier examples of that policy going way back to the First Lamanite Mission and Mission Sinai of Nauvoo and in Utah. But it really kind of, the fulfillment of that prophecy sort of just sat quiet for probably half of a century in the late 1800s until early 1900s, maybe, 1940s. It starts to really kind of, there's a movement to reach out to Native Americans again, led by Spencer Kimball. And from that point on, you see the birth of this program that's designed to provide education and spiritual training to Native Americans. And Native Americans at the same time are pretty interested in the 1940s and looking for new ways to get educated. There's a drive on the reservations completely independent of Mormons. There's a drive to build schools and to start modeling on Western education. So there's, a weird confluence where both groups had an interest in this program in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And as children were put in these foster homes, they would often go for education, but gradually religion and spirituality became one of the driving forces for signing up. And as you said, it was pretty controversial. By the 1960s and 70s, there's an awareness in American history that Indian children are being taken out of Indian homes, not just Mormons, but generally social services removing Indians. And there's, of course, the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978 to try to slow that down. And the church's program specifically was targeted by different Native American groups that thought that it was, ethnocentric and whitewashing children. And within the church, there's some shifts. The correlation movement really starts to erode the program, and there's some shuffling of bureaucracies until the 1980s when it starts to really start to decline heavily. And then finally, it ended in about 2000. But that's the program in a nutshell.
We can't forget to talk about George P. Lee and all this.
Yeah, George P. Lee, of course, is the poster child for the program in his earlier years. He was a Navajo boy who was picked up by traders who had reached out to him. I think they were assigned his home teachers or something. Well, it was before home teaching, but they were missionaries who reached out, and they were constantly trying to connect to his family, and they'd leave food and treats on the door until eventually they had a bond with his family, and they signed him up for placement after a couple years. And I think he went to Tuba City boarding school for a couple years, and then he went on placement and lived with the Harker family and became this example of success. He got educated. He played football. He went on to get a bachelor's, a master's. I think he even had a doctorate maybe. He was president of a college. He was considered running for chairman of the Navajo tribe, was eventually tabbed to be the Holbrook Mission president, which is the old Southwest Indian Mission, became the Holbrook Mission, and then eventually becomes one of the 70. And despite discouragement from speaking on Indian affairs, he continued to do so. And his interpretation of Indian issues was a little bit more controversial. He saw Lamanites as sort of a people who were destined to take leadership in the church, and that Ephraim and white folks were kind of in the way. And as he spoke more and more about that position, he alienated himself more and more from the brethren until eventually he wrote a couple of letters that he published that were pretty aggressive, and they excommunicated him.
Yeah, along with Paul Dunn, learning about sort of the excommunication of George P. Lee at General Authority was something that really awakened my mind. So we'll talk about all that during this interview. I don't want to. I guess I want to start just by jumping back a little bit. And so I think we've given a good overview. I hope the listeners are now. I hope their interest is piqued. But let's begin. I don't think we think a lot about the Book of Mormon today, potentially in terms of what it basically says about what its goal or intent is. So talk a little bit about your understanding about when Joseph Smith creates the Book of Mormon, what it has to do with Native Americans. And then you talked a little bit about the Native American mission back in, I'm going to guess, 1831. But just talk a little bit about how Native Americans tie into early Mormonism.
Well, there's a lot of, in America generally, there was a lot of questions about Native Americans and where do they come from. And there's all sorts of curiosities, the things that were created by mound builders and other civilizations, artwork that's no longer being created but was still lingering around. They wanted to explain where it came from, and there's all sorts of explanations published by different groups, different stories about lost Roman colonies and lost Welsh colonies. And, of course, there's the Book of Mormon and the lost Israelites that are there, Lehi's family. And in the Book of Mormon, as you read, there's a lot of prophecies about this seed of Manasseh, this Lehi's family, how someday they're going to be restored. It's the story of these people falling into disarray and apostasy and their civilization collapsing, but always with the promise that someday they'll come back and there'll be a restoration and they'll build a city of Zion, and Ephraim will play a role in assisting. And I think if you look at the early Mormon publications, there's references here and there that really indicate that a lot of early Mormons in the 1830s fully expected Native Americans to join the church, to take a leadership role, that they were expecting droves and droves of converts. And when they sent the Lamanite mission out in 1830 to 31, they expected that they were going to come back with tons of converts, and this was going to be the fulfillment of the prophecy. But they didn't really find the converts. They visited the Delaware and a few other tribes, Parthi Pratt's group, but they never really had the success. The only success they had was with the white folks in Kirtland, really. So when they came back and that didn't really work out, that forced people to reassess what those prophecies meant and was there going to be a restoration. And I think they held on to it for a little while longer. There's still other missions. In Nauvoo, they sent missions out to the Sioux. They sent, I think by the time you get to Nauvoo, the Indian missions become more practical. Sending missionaries to the Sioux so you have access to the Missouri River, sending missionaries to the Chippewa and the Menominees so that you have access to the lumber so we can build the temple in Nauvoo. There's an effort to still convert Indians, but less expectation that they're going to take the leadership. And then by the time you get to Utah, and it's clear that there's violence and there's conflict and it's not the pretty dream that everyone imagined, Indians sort of become more of an enemy or a nuisance, or viewed in the typical European-American attitude of Indians at the time, and less about a group of people who are going to take leadership. And I think that's what eventually Lee takes issue with, is he goes back to those old sort of attitudes and wants that to come back again.
Right. You mean George P. Lee?
Yeah.
So just real quick, what were the prophecies that we're talking about here? Were they made by Joseph Smith? Were they in the original Book of Commandments?
No, the Second Nephi somewhere it talks about the building of Zion. There's some references in there. What's his name? The apostle. Orson Pratt.
Okay,
he says some things about it, in some of his work. So there's a few newspaper clippings from the Times and Seasons or whatever, some of the early publications that make reference to the building of Zion. That Phelps is publishing. So, I mean, it's here and there a little. It's not the dominant theme at all, but it's definitely there.
And, I've heard that the Book of Mormon wasn't very emphasized by Joseph Smith in those early years of the church. And that's the true with the general membership as well. So do you have a pulse at all for how serious members even took the Book of Mormon? Would they have been looking to it and saying, wow, here's a prophecy, we need to take this thing really seriously? Were they even reading the Book of Mormon? Do you have any sense of that?
I couldn't really speak to that, except that after reading all the newspapers that I don't see a lot of Book of Mormon passages used to argue their points, but I couldn't really speak to their use of it.
Okay, so it wasn't like all the members in Kirtland were dying to convert Native Americans as a fulfillment. And so if those missions didn't work out, they're questioning Joseph's mantle as a prophet. Right. What I hear you saying is it didn't reach that level.
I don't think so. There is definitely behavior. Like there's one great story, I forget where I dug it up, it's one of the antagonistic works that's published by a non-Mormon, but he's talking about how the Mormons would get up on tree stumps and they would preach to their other Mormons as if they were Lamanites, and they would practice these ritualistic baptisms there in the open space with no water, sort of this this is what's going to happen when we get out to see the Indians. We're going to preach to them and convert them and baptize them. And so, I mean, they definitely were these noticeable themes of going out and converting Indians, but it didn't really work out that way.
Okay, so maybe Joseph and the LDS Church just kind of moved on. They kind of tried it. They hoped that it would work, but then kind of lost interest as they realized there wasn't much interest there.
Sure, absolutely. And then it fuels up again in the 1840s when they're in Utah and they start, you know, the missions there and the child adoptions there. They actually launched a program. I think they'd given up by that point, but as they get to Utah, Utes show up having raided Indians from other villages, from Goshutes and Paiutes, and they try to sell them to the Mormons. And Mormons have no interest in buying Indian slaves because Mormons are generally abolitionists, if anything. They're not particularly supportive of slavery. And then as before their very eyes, these Ute men just start killing Indian slaves, saying, well, if you won't buy them, they're of no value to us. And so the Mormons say, well, hold on, you know, what do you need? And they'll start trading rifles and food. And before you know it, Mormons are actively involved in this pre-existing Spanish Ute slave trade that was going on. And drawn back into trying to assimilate and save Indians from their darkness. So, you know, you begin more Indian outreach. You have Brigham Young, you know, issuing a command that we should all buy Indian children. And the legislature passed a law in, I think, 1852 or 50, saying what exactly needs to happen when Indians are brought in. How do you treat these adoptees, and what kind of minimum requirements? Are they indentured servants? Are they slaves? Are they family members? And that's a point of debate that's still not really settled in the historiography. There's some people who think these Indians who get adopted in the 1840s, 50s, 60s were slaves, were indentured servants, because on the census they're listed as servants sometimes. But on other censuses, they're listed as family members. And we even know some of them were sealed in the temple to the family that they were living with. So the status of them is sort of debated. But there is an outreach effort there. And there's also some demonstration farms. But most of those failed in the 1860s.
What's a demonstration farm?
Oh, the Mormons would go out and they'd start a farm. And they'd bring over local Indians and say, look, this is how you farm beets or how you farm wheat or whatever. And try to get them to become agricultural, sedentary people. Without, you know, try to move them away from their nomadic migratory patterns and civilize them as good Europeans that, you know, farm. But it didn't really take root. It generally failed one after another. But we sent out missions that did that kind of work in Las Vegas and Carson Valley and a bunch of other places on the Green River, I think. But most of them pretty much failed. The Washakie colony is probably the best known and successful one. They kind of were off and on. And then in the 1870s or so, they relocated to Brigham City and the church laid out a 7,000 acre farm and dug canals and built sawmills and schoolhouse and a mission home. And they built houses for all the Native American, the Eastern Shoshone band that was following this community, and they tried to set it up, and it kind of worked off and on. Indians would come and go. Sometimes they'd farm, sometimes they wouldn't. Sometimes they'd stay in the community, other times they'd leave, and it worked off and on up through the 1960s, I think, is when it finally was dissolved and just didn't work anymore.
And what was the name of that community again?
The Washakie Colony.
So this would have been, Boyd K. Packer would have grown up familiar with this colony.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and do you have a sense for why the church was even bothering in the 1900s to set up a colony like this?
I think it's still that lingering desire to provide outreach and support to these people who they knew were supposed to be there. They're supposed to redeem. It's supposed to happen, but it's become a secondary motive of the church. And then by the 1940s, 50s, 60s, with Packer and others that are still continuing it, and you know, there's the internationalization of the church and an effort to reach out to all sorts of people. And so it's part of that too, I suppose, by the 1960s and 70s. Well, it's fading by then, but.
Okay. It's like the title page of the Book of Mormon says, this is like to bring the Indians back to Christ or to bring the Jews or the Gentiles back. There's something about that,
sure.
Right?
Right. And part of that is to teach them proper white culture, you know, to civilize them to farming and clothing and sedentary lifestyles.
And they didn't take to that so well.
No, it didn't really work out too well.
Okay. All right. So So it sounds like there were spotty efforts here and there in the early pioneering times. I mean, just to touch on Mountain Meadows, it sounds – I mean, in that instance, we almost kind of blamed the Indians. I shouldn't say we, but okay, so as I understand it, some of those in southern Utah who participated in the Mountain Meadows Massacre tried to pin it on the Indians. Is that right?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
And but they weren't – were they heavily involved in that or
– They were involved. They were present, but it wasn't organized by them. That was – the Mountain Meadows Massacre had to do with, you know, the Arkansas pioneers moving down through Utah and having conflict with the Saints and – Of course, the Saints on the verge of war with the United States government, and Brigham Young declares martial law, and that didn't help that the Arkansas group was, I think Arkansas's where Parley P. Pratt had just been killed by a man from Arkansas had killed Parley P. Pratt, so there was some concerns about that, and they fought back and forth. Mormons, because of martial law, wouldn't trade with them, and lots of pioneers expected to be able to trade with the Mormons when they passed through Utah to help resupply, and because of martial law, they wouldn't, and so there was conflict, and there's all sorts of spotty arguments over who did what, but ultimately it led to the Mormons down there by Panguitch just committing this massacre with Indians with them. They told the Indians they could have some of the clothes and supplies that were seized from the dead, and so there were Indians that participated, but it wasn't an Indian planned
incident. And were they punished at all? Did it hurt them for having been blamed for what happened?
I'm not too familiar with it, but I don't think so.
Okay. And then anything to talk about the, you know, our relationship as Mormons with Native Americans through, let's just say, the 1960s, where things start picking up?
Yeah, it's really very quiet from early 1900s up until 1940s. There's not a whole lot going on. I think indeed it's because there's not much going on that, in the 1940s and 50s, when Kimball starts to play a role, he feels like it's a chance to fix this overlooked segment of the population. We need to reach out to them.
Okay, so Kimball really is the impetus?
Yeah, he's one of them, not for this particular program. Well, he plays a definite role, but he ends up being the driving force behind the larger Indian program of the 1950s and 60s and 70s. He's definitely the driving force.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about the foundings of this program, how it picks up, what the points of inertia are.
Okay, well, it goes back to the 1940s when Navajos and other Indians would work on a migratory seasonal agricultural circuit, and many of them would come up into southern Utah and work on the beet farms. And one particular family, the John family, Navajos, they worked regularly with some of the families there, and they had children that they brought with them who worked in the fields with them. And one of these girls, Helen John, at some point decided she wanted to stay behind and not go home during the school year, not go back to the Navajo reservation, but instead to stay there in southern Utah and attend school. And there's some debate over whose idea that was.
She was a Native American, right?
Yeah, she was Navajo, yeah.
Okay.
In Mormon folklore, she's the one that said, I want to do this. Please let me stay. I want to go to school. And there's different interviews from early people, Mormons that were involved in the program, who say, yeah, that's what happened. She's the one that wanted to do it.
My feminist friends are going to love that it was a woman.
Yeah.
demanding to be educated. It's like, I am a Lala.
But if you look at her interview, you find a different answer. Her interview says that she was encouraged by these white folks, that there's a woman named Amy Avery who took her in and would play games with her and teach her songs. And Amy Avery told her that she needed to do this. This would be a good idea for her, and kind of encouraged and promoted it. And Helen John thought, okay, well, sure, if you think so, I'll do it. But whatever the case, in 1947, Helen John decided to stay with a white family, and Amory Avery put her in contact with Golden Buchanan, who was in the state presidency in Richfield, and he was in charge of Native Americans for a variety of issues, mostly looking over migrant workers and their fair treatment. And so he took the lead in trying to find her a home. He wrote to President Kimball, who was on the Indian Committee in Salt Lake, which had sort of been almost non-functional, just barely getting rolling. It really done very little. And he said, I have this girl and I want to put her in a home. And, you know, this could be a really great program. We could expand to other Indians. And before you know it, we could have hundreds or thousands of Indians and converting them and converting their families, and we could really reach out to the reservation and transform their lives. And so President Kimball showed up on his doorstep soon after and said, yeah, let's do this program. And from that point on, President Kimball's really the promoter.
Was he a prophet at the time?
No, he was one of the seven. He was one of the 12. He had been ordained, I want to say, in the 1940s, maybe, was it? When did he get ordained?
Yeah, I'm not totally sure.
1946, he's ordained.
Okay.
Or 1943. 1943, he was ordained by Heber G. Grant. And he himself had an interest in Native Americans because it was in his patriarchal blessing that he was going to reach out to the Lamanites, it said in his blessing. And he always anticipated that would happen, but then it never really did. I think he had an interest also because of his father. His father served a mission to Indian Territory in the 1880s and was, I think, there for like 5 or 10 years and came home and surely told stories. And then also the Apache, they were in Arizona where Kimball grew up, and the San Carlos Apaches would ride on the trains there, on the tops of the trains. So they were very visible. They had made some sort of deal with the railroad company that they could ride for free on the tops of trains in exchange for rites of passage. But they would ride, and he would see them, and it was in his blessing, and he thought that was going to be his life calling. But then he got his mission call to the Swiss Austrian mission, and that wasn't what he expected, and he was kind of frustrated, and he came back home from his mission. So he ended up serving in the Central States because of World War One. But he came home from his mission, and he just went about his life there in Arizona, and opened up banking and real estate and insurance companies, and moved up in the church ranking until he was called an apostle in 1943 by Heber G. Grant. And then a couple years later is when Albert Smith pulls him aside and says, hey, I need a favor. I need you to start. President Smith said, I need you to look after the Indians. And that's when it clicks for Kimball that there it is. I finally am going to fulfill this patriarchal blessing. Now I'm going to be able to reach out to Indians. And so he becomes the heart of this whole Indian program from the 40s, 50s, 60s until his death, really driving that we need to reach out to Indians in any way possible. And the placement program is just one of the programs. We can talk about the others a little bit later. But he's definitely eager and anxious when he gets that letter from Buchanan saying, hey, I've got this girl. What should I do? Kimball is eager and ready and says, well, I want you to take her in. Let's do it now. Let's move forward. And so the program begins unofficially with the support of an apostle. The church doesn't actually approve the program for another 5 years or so, but every meeting, every chance Kimball gets, he shows up with the brother and the 12 apostles and says, you know, look at these Indians. We need to help them. And look at this article I found in the paper about Indians being hungry and about Indians who need education. And he collected all these self-interest, these personal interest stories. He actually had a whole team of people that would look up any interest story they could find, and then he would lobby the apostles to get on board. And then at the same time he's doing that, he's going out to all the stake presidents in southern Utah and rallying them and saying, hey, I want you to take in Indian kids. I want you to put them in your own family. I want you to put them on the front row of state conference. I want them highly visible. I want them given prayers. I want people to see these kids and to get involved. And he's doing it all unofficially because it's not an official program. But there you have the support of an apostle. What do you say when an apostle tells you to do something? So the program really got its push from him. And then he also, as an apostle, has other powers. Like he ends up calling Buchanan to be the Southwest Indian Mission president so that he can find Indian children and then have them pulled out of the reservation and put in white foster homes for the placement program.
So a couple things. So it sounds like if the patriarch's giving President Kimball this patriarchal blessing, you know, during the World War One time era or a little before, it sounds like, you know, we never quite got rid of our awareness about the Native Americans and a feeling of almost, is it paternalistic? Is that the right word? Kind of a, you know, it's still our duty to take care of these people. It sounds like that never really left our cultural milieu. Is that true?
No, I think you're right. I think it's something that just lingered in the background and it just was always there, but it wasn't the focus.
Not because we didn't try, but just because it never worked out when we did try. Is that right?
Right. Sure. And so there's a feeling, but it's in the background. And I think also the fact that his father served there, oftentimes you see that, you know, in a patriarchal blessing or in a mission call, there's often a historical, you know, people often get called where their father served or in a similar language, or, you know, there seems to be a connection that often happens. And I could see the patriarch knowing full well that his father served in an Indian territory mission and telling the boy, you know, well, you're going to reach out to Indians too.
So is there any way to look at this? I mean, clearly I have some Native American friends who look back on this whole program with a lot of anger and resentment. Is there any other way to look at it from Spencer B. Kimball's standpoint as just well-intended affection that and a sense of purpose and mission that he grabs to? I mean,
yeah, there's a couple of articles in the Ensign published back in this period when he's trying to persuade people of the program. And those articles don't talk about the program. They just talk about the Navajos. I think there's a two-part or three-part series called The Plight of the Navajo or something. And he talks about the poverty and how they have no education and they have no electricity and they have dirt floors and there's all these financial and as well as social problems, alcoholism. And so there's this need, and then the cold winter that comes and causes problems, and there's no running water, and there's need. And it's not just the Mormons saying that, it's the Navajos as well. In the 1940s, Navajos have this great awakening where they just want education. Prior to the 1940s, they didn't want anything to do with the white man's education. They were annoyed and frustrated. They felt like boarding schools of the 1880s to 1920s were all just a white man's scheme to assimilate them, and they resisted it. Definitely, there's great stories about Navajos seeing an Indian agent come around the canyon and they go run and hide because they don't want their kids to get snatched up. There's definite opposition up until the 1940s. And in the 1940s, things change because of the World War II, with the many Navajos serving in the war industries and finding good jobs. There's the cash starts to flow onto the reservation and you start to see a cash economy emerge. And you see people feeling like, man, if only I spoke more English, I could do better. And there's a driving interest in education during the war and after. And the Navajo Council, the tribal council, is passing bill after bill after bill, calling for more schools, calling for the federal government to give money for education, welcoming and inviting groups to do anything to help get them to school, opening up dorms off the reservation that are, or just on the edge of the reservation that are where students can cross the border and go into a local public school. So there's this huge drive within the tribe in the 1940s that matches up neatly with the Mormons feeling like they need to provide education. And so it's not just those devious Mormons, you know, it's both groups are really seeing something they both want at the same time. And what they, of course, the Navajos don't know is that when they sign up for this, it's not just education. It's going to be spiritual, cultural assimilation as well. But you know, they're both excited about the program. During the 1950s and 60s, early 60s, there's a lot of positive attitudes about it. There's certainly people who oppose to it. There's one woman who works for the Bureau of Indian Affairs who complains, and it goes all the way up the channels, and there's a big argument over it. And there's others who complain as well. But overall, the attitude was generally positive in the Bureau of Indian Affairs and within the tribe. And the church really went out of its way, too, to reach out to the tribes, and specifically the Navajos, to encourage a positive attitude. They would invite the tribal chairman to come to different conferences, and they would go visit them, and they were there. We sent our General Relief Society president attended the inauguration of President Jones, I want to say, one of the Navajo chairmen. So we can really see the church reaching out and trying to build a positive functional relationship. And most of the Navajos who are in leadership, the tribal council or whoever else, and various bureaucrats, they would have all been boarding school educated kids who didn't like the boarding schools and how assimilative they were and how forceful and how whitewashing they were, but they really liked the idea of education. And they like that these Mormons are taking their kids in and they're not whitewashing them in the same old ways. They're not cutting their hair and telling them, don't speak Navajo. Instead, the Mormons are saying, well, come on, you're special because you're Indian. You're a Lamanite. You know, we value your culture to an extent. You know, we don't want your spirituality, but we want your identity as an Indian because that's valuable and that's what we want to redeem. So there's, you know, it's not one-sided. It's both groups are really moving in that direction in the 1940s and 50s.
So are you saying that at least early on, the LDS approach, the Indian Placement Program, was more progressive in encouraging natives to embrace and and be proud of their culture and heritage?
No, not that they were. Well, they would encourage, for example, a young man serving in the placement program, participating in the program, might go to a foster home, and they would tell him, you know, you're of course a Lamanite, and you're going to be redeemed, and you need to get rid of the old ways, and no more spirituality of the, you know, no medicine men. But they would say, you know, hey, at school we need someone to talk about Indians and what's it like to be an Indian. And so he'd go to school and do a presentation about, you know, being an Indian, and, you know, he maybe even sample some of the language and show it off. And it was sort of a superficial, this is really cool, novelty act kind of things that were encouraged, not traditional things necessarily. But not, there was...
Oh, go ahead.
But there was, you know... Oh, go ahead. Yeah, there's... Yeah.
No, keep going. This is important.
Though they, you know, they... The church members... They saw it as inevitable that Native Americans would become white. They were going to become civilized. They're going to become just like everyone else in Utah.
And you mean literally white skin?
Literally white skin. Yeah.
Okay.
There's great stuff about that. There's actually, President Kimball made some comments at General Conference where he showed pictures and said, "Look, these kids are getting whiter every day," literally.
Is that a Book of Mormon prophecy that the Lamanites will blossom like a rose and their skin will become fair? Is that right?
Right, yeah. That's the assumption. I don't know if it's prophesied that their skin will become where it's prophesied that the mark will be removed. And then the mark, people often interpret that as the dark skin. And so...
Doesn't the Book of Mormon say the mark is dark skin?
I think that it's... I don't know.
Okay. That's all right. I seem to remember it saying that they're the same at some point.
They'll become fair, it says.
Yeah.
So there's an anticipation of that, and people would expect that. And President Kimball and others taught it. There's another interview from a BYU professor of biology, I think, who was talking about how it was a problem that he has to constantly face, that these Mormons come to school and they expect Indians to become white, and he's trying to teach them otherwise. So it was definitely part of popular thought. But that there would be an eventual assimilation, absolutely. But at that same time, there was a respect for some native things. You know, you should know how to do the arts and the crafts and the dances, and then things that didn't threaten Mormon theology, those things should be encouraged. And that's different than, say, the boarding schools where everything was discouraged.
Okay.
So a lot of folks were okay with the Mormon placement program. Early on, it had a lot of popular support. Even later on, there's different surveys that assess, like, what is your attitude about the program? And they would interview parents and tribal leaders and people who were in the program, people who quit the program. And overall, most of the surveys show that there was generally a positive attitude. But there were a few very loud who were opposed, and with good reason, you know, that we think of. But overall, I don't think it was nearly as negatively perceived. Especially not in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, it was not negatively perceived.
So there was doctrinal or religious motivation on the part of the LDS people. There was just altruistic, you know, there's a lot of poverty and sadness. We want to help them. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, they were complicit. Many of the Native Americans were complicit in wanting to be educated. And then there was Spencer W. Kimball kind of really trying to grow this program.
And also at the same time, the 1950s in America is a time of Indian termination. It's when tribes are being dissolved. It's the general policy of the federal government to dissolve tribes, to take away sovereignty and shift it over to the states, you know, remove the power of tribes to manage highways and public lands and things that are in the reservation. So there's a general attitude in America generally that this assimilation is inevitable. So Mormons aren't unique in this approach. They're, you know, a lot of Native Americans bought into that approach as well in the 1940s and 50s.
Okay. And so we were a little bit more progressive than the boarding schools of old that basically said, erase any Indian culture or artifacts. We said, keep them, bring them to the extent that they're entertaining and interesting. But there are certain limits to how much someone should embrace their Indian heritage and culture.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. So how does President Kimball take this from this sort of side project that Heber J. Grant gave him to becoming like a major – is it fair to say it became a major thrust and initiative within the LDS Church in the mid-20th century?
I think it's fair to say it's a major thrust. It's not just in the church. It's in Indian policy. If one of my goals is that people who teach Indian history and read about Indian history would understand that this is a huge – huge program. The federal government ran a very similar program, the voluntary relocation program, and it was going on, and it probably maxed out at 100,000 people. And the placement program at 50,000 is only half that, but that's still gigantic. That's by far the second largest relocation program of the era. It's huge, and everybody should be aware of that. And certainly within the church, it's gigantic. You can read in General Conference, there's lots of talks about the Indian programs. One of your Facebook questions someone had posted was to the effect of, I noticed in the recent years they don't use the word Lamanite as much, and I think that that's right. In the 60s and 70s, you saw that word used. There was a lot of talk about the program. It was anticipated that we're finally going to do it. This is going to happen. We're going to redeem the Indians. And there's a qualitative difference in how they use the word Lamanite. When you see the word Lamanite in General Conference today, it's someone's talking about a Lamanite army in the Book of Mormon attacking a city of some sort. Whereas when they talked about Lamanites in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, they talked about human beings that were transforming and becoming good, redeemed, you know, civilized American Mormons. So how does Kimball make this change, you asked?
Yeah.
He pushes and pushes by visiting all these different stake presidents. There's a great story from a guy named Miles Jensen that was an early administrator. When Buchanan became the mission president in the Southwest Indian Mission in 1951.
Okay. I was going to say around what year. That's perfect.
1951, Buchanan's the Southwest Indian Mission. And then he would extract children. He'd send the missionaries out, and they would tell people about this great program that was available. Missionaries would go to the boarding schools, and they would recruit people through any means that they could. Some people learned about it through their friends were doing it, and there's fun activities. And this is also the same time, or just slightly before, what Michael Quinn calls the baseball baptisms in England, where the church is using fun social activities to recruit people. Like, you know, hey, there's a baseball game. We should all go play. Just got to get baptized first. And there's actually great stories of a couple I've read that where people said, oh, we went on this bus to go to this activity, and they stopped by this building. We put on these white gowns, and we got baptized, and then we could go do the activity. So that sort of stuff's going on, and people are getting increasingly the numbers are rising of kids that are coming off the reservation and joining this program.
So they were doing those baseball baptism types of things on the Indian reservations?
Yes.
In the 50s?
In the 50s,
okay.
Yeah.
So it's like huge numbers of baptisms.
Yeah, it really 1954 is when that really starts happening, the baseball baptisms, because in 1954 the program became official, and the one real requirement the church laid out for the program was, we want to make sure these kids are all Mormon. We want to be accused of assimilating non-Mormon kids or taking kids that aren't Mormon, so we need them all to be Mormon, and that of course was required to get baptized. And I think personally, I really think that that policy was there to be fair and to protect Indians from exactly what it caused. Because I don't think that the apostles and the brethren thought that it was going to be an excuse to baptize people. I thought the opposite. They thought this will stop them from being overly zealous and getting people who aren't even Mormon. But it did the opposite. It encouraged people to baptize anyone they could find so they could participate in this program.
Was baseball part of that or not?
Sure, they played sports. Basketball was more popular on the Navajo reservation, but yeah, they played sports. They did activities. They'd take drives and go to campouts. They did all sorts of activities. And of course, the best activity being go on placement. There were rumors that if you went on placement, you'd get really good Christmas gifts, and you know, you get a vacation with this white middle-class family for 9 months, and it's all easy, and everything's nice. It's way better than, you know, living in the dirt here on the reservation. And so people would sign up for all sorts of reasons. Early on, they signed up for education, for fun, for whatever. But there was a lot of pressure, and the missionaries are out there actively recruiting for the program.
Okay, so literally the Indian placement program, you know, reservation stuff of the 50s becomes the proving ground for the baseball baptism stuff that happened in England in the late 50s and early 60s. It's almost like we learned it with the Native Americans and then applied it in the British Isles. Is that fair?
Yeah. I don't know if the folks in the British Isles looked at the Native American practices and copied it. I don't know if there's a connection, but it's certainly a similar phenomenon happening 10 years earlier. Yeah,
was Henry Moyle involved in any of the Indian Placement Program stuff that you know of?
Not that I know of.
Okay. All right. Just curious.
But yeah, it's definitely going on, and it continued through the 1960s, maybe, you know, feeling off of the baseball bats, and maybe in Europe, you know, it continues on. But at any rate, just before the program was official in 1954, you had all these people participating in an unofficial program. And one of my favorite stories is from Miles Jensen, who was the caseworker, the only real caseworker, the guy working with Kimball and with Buchanan to place the kids. So Buchanan would find the kids, and then Jensen would place them in homes. And he was out looking for people, and he would use the apostolic mantle of Kimball to say, well, I've got this apostle, and he says you should participate, and you should got to find me some people to participate. And so lots of stake presidents and bishops and people would participate. And on one occasion, he's speaking at a he attended a state conference in North St. Pete with some of these Indian kids that he was trying to get homes, or they were already placed in homes, and they're sitting on the front row, and some of them are giving speeches or giving talks or giving, they're giving prayers at state conference. And they had a guest representative. They had a member of the 12. They had Elder Peterson was there. Marky Peterson was speaking at the conference. And Peterson takes to the pulpit at the end, and he says, and this is a great quote. He says, I've been hearing about the Indian program of the church. People have been asking me, what should we do? Where will we get this help? Presumably help to, like, take an extra child in the home. How should we do this? And he answered, publicly now, and he slapped the pulpit, I want you to know there is no Indian program. The people involved better clean their doorsteps. And I think that's a hilarious example of Kimball working informally, unofficially, promoting with his apostolic mantle, and then this other apostle coming in and saying, no, that's not what we're doing. That's not the program. This is unofficial. You don't have to do this. It shows you there's not unity. There's not. They're not all on board yet.
What did he mean? What did he mean by clean your doorsteps?
I think that probably is a reference to, you know, dusting your shoes off. Sort of the old, this is something you need to either. I don't know. It's some old saying about ceasing, no longer participating in this.
So he was down. He was down on the idea.
Oh right. He was totally opposed to placement. He didn't think it was appropriate at all. That it's just not an official program. You shouldn't be pressuring people in. I don't think he supported it at all.
He isn't known as one of our more racially progressive apostles. Did it have a racial component? Maybe.
I don't know.
We don't know. Okay.
I know that a year or two later, when the program becomes official, it becomes official just as Kimball leaves town. He goes to Europe for some work, and he says, well, don't worry, Jensen, I've got a guy who will be in charge. And the guy that's in charge to help Jensen get the program launched in its first official year is Marky Peterson. And so Jensen's feeling, oh my goodness, this guy hates me and he hates our program, and now he's going to be the guy that gets us started. And it's Marky Peterson who says to Jensen, well, we've got approval, but they've all got to be baptized. And Jensen says, well, they're not. I've got, you know, school starts in a month, and I've got like 3 or 4 dozen kids, and none of them are baptized. And, you know, just a couple of them are. And Peterson says, well, then get them baptized now. And so they dunk all these kids to get them baptized so they can participate. And that's where the program continues that practice for the next, you know, few decades.
How did Peterson go from opposing it to being a leader in it?
He wasn't a leader. I think he just got assigned. I think that, you know, someone had to take care of it, and Kimball was gone, and the brethren, the apostles, the first presidency said, this is our program now. So, okay, I'll follow the program, but they've all got to be baptized according to the program. So
Kimball worked probably tirelessly. I'm just guessing here. He worked tirelessly with other apostles to build support and consensus over a long period of time?
Yes. We've got a couple interviews where he talks about people say that he would recruit from the – he had his Indian committee. The Indian committee that he's chairman of from the 1940s on would – had a few different people that came and went. Miles Jensen was on it. Buchanan was on it. Some of the early study presidents, he would come and go, and other 70 later. But in that committee, they would recruit, you know, these human interest stories to bring to the – and then every week when he met with the apostles, he would bring these stories and say, look, these poor people are in need, or look, this child is doing so wonderful, or look, this kid is in scouting now and his life has changed. And, you know, they were all sorts of promoting these ideas and helping to – so, yeah, he definitely played a role in – and then he left right when it started. But he came right back, and he continued to lead the program as a sort of a ad hoc special program that was run by his Indian committee for the next, I don't know, 5 to 10 years or so.
Did you say he left for Europe to live?
Oh, no. He just went on assignment to Europe for a week or two when the program started. And then when he comes back, he resumes leadership of the program and totally ran the program in its entirety. Even as there was lots of different reorganizations that occurred with the program, at some point they became obvious that they're moving all these kids and putting them in foster homes. They probably need a social services license of some sort. And so they involved the Relief Society presidency and that, the General Relief Society presidency, because they have, of course, a licensure. But even though the Relief Society is technically in charge, on paper the society is in charge, which means it answers to the presiding bishopric, who answers to the prophet. The reality was that Kimball's in charge. He's the one running the show, not the Relief Society, not the presiding bishopric, not the prophet.
Okay.
And that continues up until 1969.
Okay, so Kimball. Okay, so Kimball is the apostle heading this thing up, and the program becomes official in
54.
Okay, so that's kind of Eisenhower administration years. That's like Ezra Taft Benson's, you know, at some point becoming Secretary of Agriculture. It's Cold War. We're talking 50s here, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm just curious if you have anything on this. I'm thinking about B.H. Roberts, you know, back in, let's say, the 20s or 30s. I'm not exactly sure the decade. But I know that he's at some point coming up with his concerns about the historicity of the Book of Mormon. And, you know, ultimately my understanding is that even though he presents these concerns about the historicity of the Book of Mormon, that isn't received very well by the brethren, and eventually B.H. Roberts dies, and I don't know if that whole issue sort of becomes shelved. But I'm thinking about the contrast between sort of, you know, the New York Times and B.H. Roberts starting to question the historicity of the Book of Mormon, and now when the history of Mormon, Book of Mormon historicity is really under attack. But then I'm thinking about the contrast of that between how material psychologically this is going to be for the average Mormon, because for the average Mormon, the Book of Mormon starts to rise in prominence in terms of its usage. And here we have all these people, all these Native Americans being told they're Lamanites. And then we have all these members who are feeling, wow, this Book of Mormon's real, because we've got Lamanites that are living among us, and we're helping to fulfill prophecy of the Book of Mormon and the desert. You know, the Native Americans are going to blossom like a rose and become white and delightsome. Like, this had to have been a real emotional, spiritual, cultural, scriptural, powerful element for not only Kimball, but all the members who participated. This is something very tangible, right? And for the Lamanites who are assuming this new identity, I should say the Native Americans who are assuming this, you know, identity that's handed to them. Is that something you can talk about at all?
Yeah, no, you're totally right. This is a period of excitement. Every year there's a conference held for the Lamanites. It started as a conference for these kids in the placement program, but it gradually expanded to be all Native Americans and then all larger Lamanites, Latin American Islanders. And that whole evolution of the redefining the concept of Lamanite from Native Americans to Latin Americans and Pacific Islanders, and all these converts are coming in the 1940s and 50s from all these different places, led these conferences to grow larger and larger, and they had their different themes every year. And one of the themes that jumps out to me was around 1970-72. The theme of the conference was the day of the Lamanite is now. That there is this, it's happening. We are living. We are seeing the prophecies come true. In truth, Native American converts weren't that impressive. There wasn't that many of them occurring. But when you start tossing in all of the Polynesians and all of the Latin Americans, you really see there's just this huge influx of new, fresh blood to the church. And if we call them all Lamanites, then this really is quite an impressive accomplishment. So people are very much excited. And that includes some of the kids who are serving in the placement program who are being raised essentially in a Mormon, white Mormon home from a young child age. You know, they're raised being told, yes, it's you. You're the chosen one. You're the chosen choice generation. And a lot of them buy into it, and they're totally excited, and they call themselves Lamanites, and it's special to them. Certainly there are those who say this is ridiculous. These white people are trying to colonize us. But there's quite a few that think that it's a wonderful experience and that totally buy in. And they grow. They go through the program. They go on to BYU. They become adults. Many of them get careers that they're able to move on in their lives, and they look back on it fondly. There's others who look back on it as a misguided assimilation effort that, you know, at least they got them really good schooling. And then there's others who think it was just terrible all over and has no value. But at the time, I think lots of folks were on board and thought it was exciting. Even in the church, you've got both kind of a conservative. You've mentioned several times now that there was a progressive. In some ways, the church was being more progressive than boarding schools, but there's some conservative people like Peterson that maybe when you referenced Benson, some of the more conservative folks. The special thing about this program was that it appealed to both the conservative and the progressive elements of the church, because the conservatives would like to see assimilation occur, and this program provides it. And then the more progressives want to see these outreach programs, and they're seeing that happen. And so for a brief while in the 70s, both sides, the more conservative, the more progressive attitudes in the church, both were having their needs met with this program, up until the 1980s, when the two kind of schism and they don't get along so well, and there's an effort to reorganize things, and the program starts to decline. But for a while there in the 1970s, everybody's very excited about the program. It's in general conference talks. There's all these conferences every year, and in order to make the conferences, the annual conferences, they get so large eventually that they can't house all the kids. And so to participate in the conference, you had to win at a smaller regional conference, which then gets so big that they have to make even smaller district conferences. And so there's this hierarchy of conferences that Lamanite children participate in, giving speeches and doing talent shows and reading poems kind of a mixture of traditional cultural values, like they might do a traditional Indian dance. And they might show their good report card that they got good grades in English and math and science. And if you met certain requirements, whether it was GPA or winning a particular talent show or a speech contest, then you progressed on to the next conference until eventually getting to the national conference. And that was all part of the 1970s program that was very exciting for a lot of these kids. And they would go and they would give these speeches about becoming a Lamanite and about what it meant to them. And they'd have their testimony meetings, and they'd have a dance, and they might have a basketball tournament or some other parts of the conference. They'd have workshops and little firesides. But it was a huge experience for these Indian kids.
Who are they giving these speeches to? Other Indians?
Themselves. Okay. Yeah, okay. Themselves. Other Indians. They'd bring guest people to come and watch. Like they'd have different members of the church hierarchy that would come. A 70 might show up. Kimball would often be there. They'd also reach out to different tribal leaders. We know that Rimen Nakai of the Navajo tribe, he's a chairman. He goes. So does a couple other, another chairman or two. I think Jones went. I can't remember his first name. Chairman Jones. But they would reach out, and they'd often give them awards at these. Like they'd give awards to these Navajo leaders or community leaders that would come. But for the most part, they're speaking to themselves, to their own Lamanite kids that are all sort of preaching about how they love this gospel and how this program is saving them and how it's changed their lives.
And we're talking tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands over time?
To participate in the program?
Yeah.
In total, there's no number anywhere of how many actually participated. The best guess, there's two places for best guess. One of them is Claire Bishop, who was a caseworker that worked his way up to become director of the program in the 1950s or 60s, and then became an advocate, kind of speaking and supporting the program for the next couple decades. And he's still alive. He gave a comment somewhere. He said about 50,000, he thinks, is what would have participated. And he's a pretty good guess because he's in the best position to guess. The other best guess I have is I went through all the Indian Committee meeting notes, and they have sporadic, this year we have this many kids, this year we have this many kids, this is the retention rate for this year, this is the retention rate for that year, but it's incomplete and there's gaps all over the place. And I combined that with random little tidbits I could find that are published accounts in the Ensign when someone got interviewed or something, and kind of put together this wild sketch of what I think the enrollment was each year, and then totaled it up, and I came to about 45,000. So I think Claire Bishop's probably right when he says 50,000. He's in a pretty good place to guess. So 50,000 kids participated in this program from 1943 till 2000.
And how did Pacific Islanders and Central and South Americans get kind of grafted in?
Well, they'd never participate in this placement program. They're not part of the placement program, but they are grafted into the Lamanite identity. And that starts in the 1940s, a little earlier. There wasn't much work going on down there. I think we sent Pilar Piprat to Chile in 1851. But other than that, there was very little work in Latin America or the Pacific Islands until the 1930s or so. We there were some German immigrants in Buenos Aires that asked for missionaries in 1920, I think, 1920 something. And it started a little bit there. And by the 1930s, we start to send missionaries out to Latin America. 1940s, we start sending missionaries to the Cook Islands or to the Polynesian Islands. Our first branch presidencies organized in the Pacific Islands in 1946 and the chapel the next year. And by 1950s and 60s, you're starting to see lots of converts, both in the Pacific Islands and in Latin America. And there's a need to place them someplace. What do we do with these people? How do we classify them? How do we recognize them? What are they? And it seemed very convenient at a time when the church was watching the Lamanite program blossom. There was a placement program. There was an Indian seminary program. There was these missions all over, the Southwest Indian Mission, and then these other missions going to these people who are brown-skinned, and a need to sort of clump them together and make sense of it by calling them all Lamanites. Of course, also, there's the archaeological stuff going on. In the 1940s, I think Armand Moss, one of his books, talks about how in the 1940s, there's an archaeological thrust in the 1940s that the Department of Archaeology at BYU is founded, and the New World Archaeology Foundation is organized in the 50s, and Farms comes a couple decades later. But there's this thrust to make sense and order out of the ancient peoples of the Book of Mormon, and well, maybe they're the people of Latin America, maybe they're the people of you know, Guatemala or Mexico or someplace. And so, you know, the Lamanite identity is a convenient place to put everybody together in one category. The non-white people, who are these special chosen people of God, who at some point are going to be restored, and look, they're all joining the church in droves now. So this must be the fulfillment of the prophecy. Now we can feel good about ourselves that we've, you know, accomplished this prophecy, and it's happening.
And I'm just curious, I kind of am trying to figure this out. What makes the Pacific Islanders grouped in as Lamanites? Is there some archaeological find? Is this John Sorensen? Like, how did they get I could see Latin Americans because they're all, you know, we don't know. We think that Nephi and Laman, maybe they lived in Central America, for those who believe the Book of Mormon's historical. So I could see the Americas, but I'm just curious if there's any history on how Native Pacific Islanders got lumped in. Anything?
I can't tell you for sure where it comes from that the Polynesians are Lamanites, but in 1967, the Ensign magazine has an article clearly identifying Latin Americans and Polynesians as Lamanites. And then a year later, in 1967, the church produced a Lamanite handbook, which continued to explain that Lamanites are inclusive of Indians and Latin Americans and Polynesians. And then in 1968 also, the church launched its religious education program out in the Polynesian Islands, where we started building high schools and colleges. And there was a definite commitment to the Polynesian Island people that the church was involved in their redemption, you know, their education there. And that continued for a long time, that the church operated dozens and dozens of schools in the Polynesian Islands, and it expanded into Mexico and Chile and all over the place, but always in places that we could call Lamanites. I'm not aware of it. Yeah. So there's a huge presence there.
And I'm surprised to learn that, you know, when I think about places like Tonga and Samoa, you know, it just seems like we Mormons populate a huge percentage of those populations now. And I'm just kind of a stunned to hear that we didn't start working there until the mid, you know, 1900s. And you fast forward 50 or 60 years, and we might even be the most predominant religion on some of those islands. Is that right?
Yeah, I think you're totally right, which people need to make sense of that. Why is that so? And the easiest answer is, well, because they're Lamanites, and it was prophesied that they would all, you know, come around. So now it's happening. They must be Lamanites.
And I can tell you, when I served in Guatemala from 88 to 90, it was still absolutely part of what we did to teach these people that they were Lamanites. We would connect their identities literally to the Book of Mormon, and they would call themselves Lamanites. Mm-hmm. And that was just part of their identity and part of their narrative all the way through.
Yeah, it's amazing how that's changed, that I don't hardly hear that term anymore as part of people's identity.
Yeah.
One, two, three. Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy.